It's a turbulent time for religion in China. Many religious minorities feel like they're under attack. Officials have forbidden Muslim civil servants from fasting during Ramadan and prohibited Muslim women from wearing headscarves and robes. Others have harassed Catholic priests and bishops and ordered Christian churches to take down their crosses. Security forces have arrested Tibetan Buddhist monks, imprisoned members of the banned Falun Gong sect, and restricted travel for Uyghur Muslims. But at the same time, China's undergoing a religious revival. Young Chinese are rediscovering the religions of their grandparents and discovering some new ones as well. Tourists and worshippers are flocking to newly renovated temples, and the officially atheist communist government, which once destroyed temples and jailed religious leaders, is promoting and sometimes even funding this resurgence. But critics say it's less a green light for religious expression than a flashing yellow. Proceed with caution. Which brings us to our feature story for today from independent producer Ruth Morris.
A piano lesson spills into a tiny lane in one of Shanghai's colonial neighborhoods. On the corner, a street vendor fries up breakfast eggs, and a recycler on a three-wheel bicycle signals he's making the rounds. Upstairs in a small apartment, a 31-year-old woman, Anna, copies Buddhist religious texts into a notebook.
I think it helps me to understand it. And then also, it creates good karma.
Anna is not this woman's real name, and her study of religion is something she typically keeps pretty private. Anna belongs to a new crop of Chinese citizens, well-educated, often city dwellers, who are helping to revive Buddhism under the rule of China's Communist Party, which is officially atheist. Anna grew up with a father who was staunchly anti-religion. He grew up under the Communist Party system and is a party member. He told her that religion was the tool of emperors used to manipulate the masses. Anna's grandfather believed the same. He was uncomfortable with anything to do with Buddhism.
And we had a Buddha, it was an antique, on the table, and he criticized it for a long time until my mom had to tell him, it's not religion, it's just an investment. We hope to sell it sometime later to make money because there's no other way to shut him up. He just hates religion.
These days, the Communist Party is more tolerant of religion, as long as people worship in state-controlled settings. But Anna still keeps a low profile. She isn't just discreet out of habit or respect for her family. Her small Buddhist study group meets in private to avoid harassment.
One Saturday, we were having a class, and there was suddenly someone knocking on the door. The woman who was responsible for the class went very tense, and she asked us to stay quiet. So she went over to answer the door, and later she came back and saying that was from the police. So it's someone living in the building has reported to the police that there were a bunch of people in that room doing something. So the police came to check on us. After that, we had to stop the class for a few weeks.
Authorities mostly tolerate private religious study groups, but could shut them down at any moment. And there's something else that makes Anna's situation tricky. She studies Tibetan Buddhism. The Communist Party considers Tibet's exiled spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, as a criminal and a separatist. The government even decreed that certain Tibetan spiritual leaders must seek the government's permission to reincarnate.
Demonstrators, the authorities had warned protesters in the Tibetan capital to give themselves up or face punishment.
This newscast reports on a time when tensions exploded into a violent uprising, 2008. The government cracked down hard, sending some monks to patriotic education classes. Since 2009, more than 100 Tibetans have set themselves on fire to protest Chinese rule.
They want to promote Buddhism. They want people to believe in Buddhism, but it's the form of Buddhism that they can control and they agree.
So To others in China, like Alan Ying, a little government oversight is fine so long as Buddhism in some form is allowed to flourish. Ying is a 30-year-old entrepreneur who studies Chinese Buddhism. He's wearing a T-shirt that says, "Be merciful."
There's two ways to enter, to step in the inside.
Walking around the Arhat Temple in Chongqing, about 900 miles west of Shanghai, he points out the statues of life-size spiritual bodyguards. Like many lay Buddhists in China, he sees the relationship between the government and temples like this one as a win-win.
Definitely a win-win. Because if, you know, the government does some work, some solid work to promote Buddhism in China, I think will help a lot to elevate the image of the government. Buddhism actually is very important in a lot of Chinese people's mind.
Like Anna, Alan sees Buddhism as a grounding force in his life. And he thinks it's good for China as a nation, too, a kind of stabilizer. For the last 30 years, spectacular economic growth has brought unimaginable wealth to China. Alan says it's like candy to a child.
Before, you didn't have any candy, right? You don't know what, sweet or something? But one day, you had so many candies. You know, you just try to grab as many as possible, you know? You don't care about whether, you know, eating too much is bad for your health.
He says too much money made people sick.
And then I started to go to the doctor. I think Buddha or Buddhist teachings are doctors. And then they realized that when they become rich, actually they live like kind of a spiritually poor life.
As Alan wanders around Arhat Temple, visitors step through latticed doors and kowtow to dusty Buddha statues. Shiny skyscrapers tower overhead. In a building off to the side, we find the temple's philanthropy office. Alan strikes up a conversation with Miss Jiang. She's an administrator at the office. She's in her 60s. As she speaks with Alan, she mentions something that hints at how the government and this particular form of Buddhism work together today. The Buddhism Philanthropy Office where Ms. Jiang works reports to the local Civil Affairs Bureau on how much money they collect from donors. The government then guides the temple on how to spend it. She says the Philanthropy Office pays school fees for underprivileged kids in the mountains nearby, and they might cover medical care for someone who can't afford it. One time, the temple paid the doctor's bills for a man who was bitten by a snake. Experts say this relationship between Buddhism and the state is a two-way road.
The cooperation we see, which is taking place, is both sides are getting something out of it.
Carrie Kasel is the author of Religion and Authoritarianism, Cooperation, Conflict, and the Consequences.
I mean, usually the state, because it's an authoritarian regime, the state is always getting a little bit more.
Kasel says Buddhist charities help China's most needy, which is important because with the economic boom came rising inequality across China. Most local governments don't have many social welfare programs in place to fill the gap, but money from faith communities can take some of the pressure off. In today's Communist Party speak, Buddhist charities promote social harmony. In exchange, Kasel says, the party doesn't interfere much inside temple walls.
And we know that political winds can shift quite quickly in China. And so having a positive collaborative relationship with the government is important for these religious communities. It ensures their survival, their prosperity, and the state is essentially still the only game in town.
This collaborative relationship began in the 80s and 90s, Kasel says, when Buddhists began repairing temples and relics vandalized during the Cultural Revolution. Local government saw a chance to boost tourism, which in turn invigorated local commerce. They pitched in for renovations or secured interest-free loans for the projects. In return, the local government often got part or all of the money from entrance fees. Tourism grew, and so did Buddhism, and so did the temple-state partnership. At Jade Buddha Temple in Shanghai, a monk leads a hushed tour group through a photo gallery. He stops in front of a picture that many Chinese couldn't have imagined 40 years ago, the temple's abbot standing confidently beside communist leader Xi Jinping when he was local party chief. Outside the gallery, in a courtyard festooned with prayer ribbons, an electric board scrolls through the names of wealthy donors. It's noisy here. The temple is using these donations to build a new wing, in part to accommodate even more tourists. Miao Ling, a feisty 87-year-old monk master, was the main speaker at the groundbreaking for that new wing last year. He credits the government with creating the conditions for Buddhism to thrive. He says Buddhism has a harmonious relationship with the government.
I am a Chinese citizen and a Chinese monk, not a foreign one. The Communist Party is our nation's leader. Buddhism is not a political actor, so it won't have any political conflicts. So Buddhism obeys the leadership of the country. We recommend believing in Buddhism and being patriotic.
In addition to all the construction at Jade Buddha Temple, there's something else that's impossible to ignore: commerce. This group of monks is moving between altars, chanting for a deceased devotee. It costs about $1,500 US for 10 monks to perform this rite. But for $6,000, 40 monks will do it. There's also a poster advertising blessings for your car. The more expensive the model, the more expensive the blessing. Some see commercialism as a dangerous side effect of Buddhism's state-sponsored revival.
This is like you're buying something from a store.
That's Anna again. She's the woman we met earlier who's studying Tibetan Buddhism. She says some big temples charge huge fees for the privilege of lighting the first round of incense on Chinese New Year.
It's always some rich businessman or some officials that gets into going first. I don't think that's Buddhism, because if you pay the big money and then you be the first one to burn the incense, in return, the Buddhas will protect you. Doesn't that make the Buddha also a corrupted official?
Once a month, devotees gather before dawn at Jade Buddha Temple for a wildlife release. It's a practice meant to show compassion by releasing fish and eels and snails into the wild, usually rivers. At the front of the gathering, monks pray over frothy vats of live fish, and then they load them all into a minivan to be dumped off at a nearby bridge. But it's not easy, because fishermen are waiting for the fish a bit further downstream, nets in hand. The temple volunteers move to the middle of the bridge to give the fish a fighting chance. In China, it could be an analogy for Buddhism itself. Some fish have been spared, but there are still nets in the water. For Interfaith Voices, I'm Ruth Morris in Shanghai, China.
We're joined today by two people who have written extensively about the relationship between religion and state in modern China. Ian Johnson is a Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for The New York Times, The New Yorker, and The New York Review of Books. He's currently working on a book on religion in contemporary China. And he joins us from his home in Beijing. Welcome to Interfaith Voices, Ian.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
And also with us today is Rebecca Nadostup, an historian at Brown University and the author of Superstitious Regimes, Religion and the Politics of Chinese Modernity. She joins us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Welcome to the show, Rebecca.
I'm very glad to be here.
The story we just heard ended with a metaphor about fish. And it said that fish can swim, meaning the Chinese people are technically free to practice a religion, but the government can scoop them up in its net anytime. Is that a fair metaphor for how the Chinese government deals with religion today?
I think it is a fair metaphor, although I think that the government tries to do a lot of things in terms of religion, but isn't always successful. So it doesn't have quite the power that we sometimes think it does. It's like that in religion and a lot of other areas also, like the economy, where they imagine they have plans and try to implement them, but are not always successful.
So there are fish that are swimming in different kinds of ways that are not controlled by the government.
Right. They slip away. Exactly.
Rebecca?
Yes, I agree with Ian's take, and I think that the government sees officially sanctioned religion and religious associations as a conduit for prestige and a link to China's heritage and history on the one hand, and also as a conduit for control over the religious activity, which is going to evolve and bubble up with or without the consent of the government itself.
Now, we've just heard our reporter, Ruth Morris, refer to the relationship between Chinese Buddhism and the state as sort of a you-scratch-my-back-I'll-scratch-yours relationship is what it sounds like. Are these fundamentally, do you think, from the government's point of view, business relationships? Or are there political dimensions to it? Is it a way of cementing government power? How do you see that?
I think you see all elements in that. There's a commercial element, but the government, I don't think, is really making a lot of money off this because China has a huge economy and tourism is overall pretty small. I think overall the government is hoping that religion can provide some sort of moral compass in society, and that this, in a way, will stabilize society and make it more predictable and easier for the government to run. I think that's how the government hopes it will play out. How it really will play out is probably something quite different.
Rebecca?
I think what we see now is efforts by the government to promote religion in terms of heritage and tourism. But we also see this incredible bubbling up in efforts to rebuild temples of all kinds, Buddhist, Taoist, local religion, so-called folk religion, and then Christian churches and mosques and so on.
Ian, would you say there has been then a surge of interest in religion in China, or is it just a question of people being more open about their beliefs?
No, I think there's been a resurgence in religious practice and interest in religion. You know, it's a bit simple to put it this way, but I think there's a lot of truth to it that China's had 35 years of economic boom, and a lot of people have got their basic problems taken care of. They have a roof over their head, and they've got enough clothes to wear and food to eat, and they're wondering what else is there. What should a society have at its core? What are the values that hold people together? And what are the things that make life meaningful? And so that's why you have a revival of the established religions, but also all kinds of spiritual directions like vegetarianism or smaller religions also like Baha'ism and so on.
So the Chinese government is officially atheist. And if you check the polls, most Chinese people don't claim to belong to any religious group. But you're both saying that China really is quite a religious country.
Absolutely. There was a survey done in 2010 by a scholar named Anna Sun, where they went around and asked questions like, have you gone to a temple recently? Have you offered incense? Do you have a portrait or an image of the Buddha in your house? Do you have a portrait of Confucius in your house? Do you have an ancestral altar? And so when we start to think of religion more broadly like that in terms of actions, yes, absolutely, most people are religious.
That's historian Rebecca Nadostup from Brown University. Also with us is journalist Ian Johnson. We'll be back after a break. Welcome back to Interfaith Voices. I'm Maureen Fiedler. Today, we're visiting China as part of our God and Government series. Mao Zedong, who led China's communist revolution in 1949, saw religion as reactionary and anti-modern. In the 1960s and 70s, his government waged war on religious institutions, destroying temples and churches and jailing religious leaders. But after Mao died in 1976, a new constitution was written that made room for religion. The government was still officially atheist, but citizens had the freedom to believe what they wanted to believe. That's still true today. Within limits. The Constitution recognizes only five religions: Buddhism, Taoism, Islam, Catholicism, and Protestantism. And it tolerates only those religious practices it considers normal, which leaves millions of believers in a state of uncertainty, or in some cases, in active conflict with the state. We've been talking with journalist Ian Johnson in Beijing and historian Rebecca Nadostup. Rebecca, in the story we heard earlier, we met a woman who is interested in Tibetan Buddhism as opposed to Chinese Buddhism. But she feels she has to study in private because she's afraid the government will harass her. Is she right to be worried?
I think that she is somewhat right to be worried, but I think she's also much luckier than some other Tibetan Buddhists. As an educated dweller of a coastal city who is studying privately, she is much better off than Tibetan Buddhists in Tibet, or especially in the Tibetan regions of places mm-hmm. like Sichuan. Those people are worried about the continued existence of their way of life, which includes religion, but is also tied to economy and ethnicity. The reason why I think that she has some cause to be worried is I think her comment was very interesting about the moment when the police came. Her friend's neighbor had reported the meeting of some people that were doing something, gathering to do something. And it wasn't stated that it was suspected that they were actually doing anything religious. And I think that that points to the sort of overall attitude of the government that large gatherings of people or unauthorized gatherings of people is something to worry about. And so that explains one aspect of the state's overall attitude towards religion. If it's unsanctioned and it's growing without control, then that's something to be concerned about.
But would your sense be that the government wouldn't have a problem with Tibetan Buddhism if there weren't a political problem between Tibet and China?
I think the politics is the essence of the problem, mm-hmm. yes. That is the essence of the problem with religion in many of the so-called border regions, you know, including Islam in the Northwest. It's not – the government doesn't necessarily have a problem with Islam. It has a problem with control over its border regions, and it has a problem with control over different ethnicities.
Yeah, I think the key point there is the government doesn't really like religions that have foreign ties. So that, of course, is the problem inherently with Tibetan Buddhism because of the Dalai Lama, with Catholicism because of the Pope, with Islam because the centers of Islam are overseas, outside of China. I think the government's very worried about that sort of thing. The sort of so-called indigenous religions or traditions, say Taoism and Buddhism, which obviously came from India, but that was 2,000 years ago, spiritual or philosophical ideas like Confucianism have a much easier time. The Catholic Church, of course, has huge problems in China because there are no relations between the Vatican and Beijing. And Protestants have a continued source of tension there also, because there are large numbers of underground Christians who don't belong to the official state churches. And recently, over the past year, there's been a campaign to remove crosses from churches in some parts of China. you know, one shouldn't exaggerate this, but I think there's definitely a campaign there. And you can see in the comments from Xi Jinping, the leader of China, that he has said some very favorable things about Confucianism and about Buddhism, but he hasn't said anything favorable about Christianity or Islam.
Now, Rebecca, Buddhism has a long history of distrusting or rejecting worldly wealth. The Buddha himself, for example, renounced his fortune in order to focus on living a more spiritual life. How does the government reconcile its support for Buddhism with economic policies that encourage the accumulation of wealth?
That's a very good question. You're absolutely right that in theory and theology, Buddhism is about the rejection of worldly trappings. In historical practice, however, Buddhist monasteries all over the world, and certainly in China, have accumulated wealth and power. Of course, there is also an element of conspicuous consumption. In terms of people using, displaying their piety through consumption, I've visited myself the Arhat Temple in Chongqing, and I've seen people vying to present on the Buddha's birthday sticks of incense that are taller and wider than you and me. and that's clearly, there's clearly something going on there, which is about displaying not just piety, a little bit more than just piety.
My incense is bigger than your incense.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes, I would think so. Like everything else, it's two-sided.
That was historian Rebecca Nadostop of Brown University. She's the author of Superstitious Regimes, Religion and the Politics of Chinese Modernity. And joining us from Beijing was Ian Johnson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent with The New York Times, The New Yorker, and The New York Review of Books. He's currently writing a book on religion in contemporary China. Thank you both for joining us on Interfaith Voices.
Thank you very much.